Lee nodded. He sat on the bench again and ran his fingers over and over the turquoise ring while Grumman gathered the few goods he needed into a deerskin bag, and then the two of them went back down the forest track to the village. The headman spoke at some length. More and more of the villagers came out to touch Grumman's hand, to mutter a few words, and to receive what looked like a blessing in return. Lee, meanwhile, was looking at the weather. The sky was clear to the south, and a fresh-scented breeze was just lifting the twigs and stirring the pine tops. To the north, the fog still hung over the heavy river, but it was the first time for days that there seemed to be a promise of clearing it. At the rock where the landing stage had been, he lifted Grumman's pack into the boat and filled the little engine, which fired at once. He cast off, and with the shaman in the bow, the boat sped down with the current, darting under the trees and skimming out into the main river so fast that Lee was afraid for Hester, crouching just inside the gunwale. But she was a seasoned traveller, he should have known that. Why was he so damn jumpy? They reached the port at the river's mouth to find every hotel, every lodging house, every private room commandeered by soldiers. Not just any soldiers, either. These were troops of the Imperial Guard of Muscovy, the most ferociously trained and lavishly equipped army in the world, and one sworn to uphold the power of the Magisterium. Lee had intended to rest a night before setting off, because Grumman looked in need of it, but there was no chance of finding a room.
"What's going on?"
he said to the boatman when he returned the hired boat.
"We don't know. The regiment arrived yesterday and commandeered every billet, every scrap of food, and every ship in the town. They'd have had this boat, too, if you hadn't taken it."
"Do you know where they're going?"
"North. There's a war going to be fought, by all accounts. The greatest war ever known."
"North? Into that new world?"
"That's right. And there's more troops coming. This is just the advance guard. There won't be a loaf of bread or a gallon of spirit left in a week's time. You did me a favor taking this boat. The price has already doubled."
There was no sense in resting up now, even if they could find a place. Full of anxiety about his balloon, Lee went at once to the warehouse where he'd left it, with Grumman beside him. The man was keeping pace. He looked sick, but he was tough. The warehousekeeper, busy counting out some spare engine parts to a requisitioning sergeant of the guard, looked up briefly from his clipboard.
"Balloon? Too bad. Requisitioned yesterday. You can see how it is. I've got no choice."
Hester flicked her ears, and Lee understood what she meant.
"Have you delivered the balloon yet?"
"They're going to collect it this afternoon."
"No, they're not, because I have an authority that trumps the guard."
And he showed the warehouseman the ring he'd taken from the finger of the dead Skraeling on Nova Zembla. The sergeant beside him at the counter stopped what he was doing and saluted at the sight of the church's token. But for all his discipline, he couldn't prevent a flicker of puzzlement passing over his face.
"So, we'll have the balloon right now, and you can set some men to fill it. And I mean at once. And that includes food and water and ballast."
The warehouseman looked at the sergeant, who shrugged and then hurried away to see to the balloon. Lee and Grumman withdrew to the wharf, where the gas tanks were, to supervise the filling and talk quietly.
"Where did you get that ring?"
"Off a dead man's finger. Kind of risky using it, but I couldn't see another way of getting my balloon back. You reckon that sergeant suspected anything?"
"Of course he did. But he's a disciplined man. He won't question the church. If he reports it at all, we'll be away by the time they can do anything about it. Well, I promised you a wind, Mr. Scoresby. I hope you like it."
The sky was blue overhead now, and the sunlight was bright. To the north, the fog bank still hung like a mountain range over the sea, but the breeze was pushing them back and back, and Lee was impatient for the air again. As the balloon filled and began to swell up beyond the edge of the warehouse roof, Lee checked the basket and stowed all his equipment with particular care. For in the other world, who knew what turbulence they'd meet? His instruments, too, he fixed to the framework with close attention, even the compass, whose needle was swinging around the dial quite uselessly. Finally, he lashed a score of sandbags around the basket for ballast. When the gas bag was full and leaning northward in the buffeting breeze, and the whole apparatus straining against the stout ropes anchoring it down, Lee paid the warehouseman with the last of his gold and helped Grumman into the basket. Then he turned to the men at the ropes to give the order to let go. But before they could do so, there was an interruption. From the alley at the side of the warehouse came the noise of pounding boots, moving at the double, and a shout of command.
"Halt!"
The men at the ropes paused, some looking that way, some looking to Lee, and he called sharply,
"Let go! Cast off!
Two of the men obeyed, and the balloon lurched up, but the other two had their attention on the soldiers, who were moving quickly around the corner of the building. Those two men still held their ropes fast around the bollards, and the balloon lurched sickeningly sideways. Lee grabbed at the suspension ring. Grumman was holding it too, and his demon had her claws tight around it.
Let go, you damn fools! She's going up!
The buoyancy of the gas bag was too great, and the men, haul as they might, couldn't hold it back. One let go, and his rope lashed itself loose from the bollard. But the other man, feeling the rope lift, instinctively clung on instead of letting go. Lee had seen this happen once before, and dreaded it. The poor man's demon, a heavy-set husky, howled with fear and pain from the ground as the balloon surged up towards the sky, and 5 endless seconds later it was over. The man's strength failed. He fell half-dead and crashed into the water. But the soldiers had their rifles up already. A volley of bullets whistled past the basket, one striking a spark from the suspension ring and making Lee's hands sting with the impact, but none of them did any damage. By the time they fired their second shot, the balloon was almost out of range, hurtling up into the blue and speeding out over the sea. Lee felt his heart lift with it. He'd said once to Serafina Pekkala that he didn't care for flying, that it was only a job. But he hadn't meant it. Soaring upward with a fair wind behind and a new world in front, what could be better in this life? He let go of the suspension ring and saw that Hester was crouching in her usual corner, eyes half closed. From far below and a long way back came another futile volley of rifle fire. The town was receding fast, and the broad sweep of the river's mouth was glittering in the sunlight below them.
Well, Dr. Grumman, I don't know about you, but I feel better in the air. I wish that poor man had let go of the rope, though. It's so damned easy to do, and if you don't let go at once, there's no hope for you.
Thank you, Mr. Scoresby. You managed that very well. Now we settle down and fly. I would be grateful for those furs. The air is still cold.
Chapter 11. The Belvedere. In the great white villa in the park, Will slept uneasily, plagued with dreams that were filled with anxiety and with sweetness in equal measure, so that he struggled to wake up and yet longed for sleep again. When his eyes were fully open, he felt so drowsy that he could scarcely move, and then he sat up to find his bandage loose and his bed crimson. He struggled out of bed and made his way through the heavy, dust-filled sunlight and silence of the great house down to the kitchen. He and Lyra had slept in servants' rooms under the attic, not feeling welcomed by the stately four-poster beds in the grand rooms farther down, and it was a long, unsteady walk.
Will,
she said at once, her voice full of concern, and she turned from the stove to help him to a chair. He felt dizzy. He supposed he'd lost a lot of blood. Well, there was no need to suppose, with the evidence all over him. And the wounds were still bleeding.
I was just making some coffee. Do you want that first, or shall I do another bandage? I can do whichever you want, and there's eggs in the coal cabinet, but I can't find any baked beans.
This isn't a baked beans kind of house. Bandage first. Is there any hot water in the tap I want to wash? I hate being covered in this.
She ran some hot water and he stripped to his underpants. He was too faint and dizzy to feel embarrassed, but Lyra became embarrassed for him and went out. He washed as best he could and then dried himself on the tea towels that hung on a line by the stove. When she came back, she'd found some clothes for him, just a shirt and canvas trousers and a belt. He put them on and she tore a fresh tea towel into strips and bandaged him tightly again. She was badly worried about his hand. Not only were the wounds bleeding freely still, but the rest of the hand was swollen and red. But he said nothing about it, and neither did she. Then she made the coffee and toasted some stale bread, and they took it into the grand room at the front of the house, overlooking the city. When he'd eaten and drunk, he felt a little better.
You'd better ask the alethiometer what to do next. Have you asked her anything yet?
No, I'm only going to do what you ask from now on. I thought of doing it last night, but I never did. And I won't either, unless you ask me to.
Well, you better do it now. There's as much danger here as there is in my world now. There's Angelica's brother for a start, and if...
He stopped because she began to say something, but she stopped as soon as he did. Then she collected herself and went on.
Will, there was something that happened yesterday that I didn't tell you. I should have, but there was just so many other things going on. I'm sorry.
And she told him everything she'd seen through the window of the tower while Giacomo Paradisi was dressing Will's wound. Tullio being beset by the spectres, Angelica seeing her at the window and her look of hatred, and Paolo's threat.
And do you remember when she first spoke to us? Her little brother said something about what they were all doing. He said, he's going to get... And she wouldn't let him finish. She smacked him, remember? I bet he was going to say Tullio was after the knife, and that's why all the kids came here. Because if they had the knife, they could do anything. They could even grow up without being afraid of spectres.
What did it look like when he was attacked?
To her surprise, he was sitting forward, his eyes demanding and urgent. She tried to remember exactly.
He started counting the stones in the wall. He sort of felt all over them, but he couldn't keep it up. In the end, he sort of lost interest and stopped. Then he was just still.
She finished, and seeing Will's expression, she said...
Why?
Because I think maybe they come from my world after all, the spectres. If they make people behave like that, I wouldn't be surprised at all if they came from my world. And when the guild men opened their first window, if it was into my world, the spectres could have gone through then.
But you don't have spectres in your world. You never heard of them, did you?
Maybe they're not called spectres. Maybe we call them something else.
Lyra wasn't sure what he meant, but she didn't want to press him. His cheeks were red and his eyes were hot.
Anyway,
she went on, turning away.
The important thing is that Angelica saw me in the window. And now that she knows we've got the knife, she'll tell all of them. She'll think it's our fault that her brother was attacked by spectres. I'm sorry, Will, I should have told you earlier, but there was just so many other things.
Well, I don't suppose it would have made any difference. He was torturing the old man. And once he knew how to use the knife, he'd have killed both of us if he could. We had to fight him.
I just feel bad about it, Will. I mean, he was their brother. And I bet if we were them, we'd have wanted the knife too.
Yes, but we can't go back and change what happened. We had to get the knife to get the alethiometer back. And if we could have got it without fighting, we would.
Yeah, we would.
Like Yorick Birnison, Will was a fighter truly enough. So she was prepared to agree with him when he said it would be better not to fight. She knew it wasn't cowardice that spoke, but strategy. He was calmer now and his cheeks were pale again. He was looking into the middle distance and thinking.
It's probably more important now to think about Sir Charles and what he'll do, or Mrs. Coulter. Maybe if she's got this special bodyguard they were talking about, these soldiers who had their demons cut away, maybe Sir Charles is right and they'll be able to ignore the spectres. You know what I think? I think what they eat, the spectres... is people's demons.
But children have demons too, and they don't attack children. It can't be that.
Then it must be the difference between children's demons and grown-ups. There is a difference, isn't there? You told me once that grown-ups' demons don't change shape. It must be something to do with that. And if these soldiers of hers haven't got demons at all, maybe the spectres won't attack them either, like Sir Charles said.
Yeah, could be. And she wouldn't be afraid of spectres anyway. She ain't afraid of anything. And she's so clever, Will, honest. And she's so ruthless and cruel. She could boss them, I bet she could. She could command them like she does people, and they'd have to obey her, I bet. Lord Boreal is strong and clever, but she'll have him doing what she wants in no time. Oh, Will, I'm getting scared again, thinking what she might do. I'm going to ask the alethiometer, like you said. Thank goodness we got that back anyway.
She unfolded the velvet bundle and ran her hands lovingly over the heavy gold.
I'm going to ask about your father and how we can find him. See, I put the hands to point at...
No. Ask about my mother first. I want to know if she's all right.
Lyra nodded and turned the hands before laying the alethiometer in her lap and tucking her hair behind her ears to look down and concentrate. Will watched the light needle swing purposefully around the dial, darting and stopping and darting on as swiftly as a swallow feeding, and he watched Lyra's eyes, so blue and fierce and full of clear understanding. Then she blinked and looked up.
She's safe still. This friend that's looking after her, she's ever so kind. No one knows where your mother is, and the friend won't give her away.
Will hadn't realized how worried he'd been. At this good news he felt himself relax, and as a little tension left his body, he felt the pain of his wound more sharply.
Thank you. All right, now ask about my father.
But before she could even begin, they heard a shout from outside. They looked out at once. At the lower edge of the park in front of the first houses of the city, there was a belt of trees, and something was stirring there. Pantalaimon became a lynx at once, and padded to the open door, gazing fiercely down.
It's the children!
Both Will and Lyra stood up. The children were coming out of the trees, one by one, maybe 40 or 50 of them. Many of them were carrying sticks. At their head was the boy in the striped T-shirt, and it wasn't a stick that he was carrying. It was a pistol.
There's Angelica!
Lyra whispered, pointing. Angelica was beside the leading boy, tugging at his arm, urging him on. Just behind them, her little brother, Paolo, was shrieking with excitement, and the other children, too, were yelling and waving their fists in the air. Two of them were lugging heavy rifles. Will had seen children in this mood before, but never so many of them, and the ones in his town didn't carry guns. They were shouting, and Will managed to make out Angelica's voice high over them all.
You killed my brother and you stole the knife, you murderers! You made the specters get him! You killed him and we'll kill you! You ain't gonna get away! We're gonna kill you same as you killed him!
Will, you could cut a window,
Lyra said urgently, clutching his good arm.
We could get away easy.
Yeah, and where would we be? In Oxford, a few yards from Sir Charles's house in broad daylight. Probably in the main street in front of a bus. I can't just cut through anywhere and expect to be safe. I've got to look first and see where we are, and that'd take too long. There's a forest or woods or something behind this house. If we can get up there in the trees, we'll be safer.
Lyra looked out the window, furious.
They must have seen us last night. I bet they was too cowardly to attack us on their own, so they rounded up all their mothers. I should have killed her yesterday. She's as bad as her brother. I'd like to...
Stop talking and come on.
He checked that the knife was strapped to his belt, and Lyra put on her little rucksack with the alethiometer and the letters from Will's father. They ran through the echoing hall, along the corridor and into the kitchen, through the scullery and into a cobbled court beyond it. A gate in the wall led out into a kitchen garden, where beds of vegetables and herbs lay baking under the morning sun. The edge of the woods was a few hundred yards away, up a slope of grass that was horribly exposed. On a knoll to the left, closer than the trees, stood a little building, a circular, temple-like structure with columns all the way around, and an upper story open like a balcony from which to view the city.
Let's run,
said Will, though he felt less like running than like lying down and closing his eyes. With Pantalaimon flying above to keep watch, they set off across the grass. But it was tussocky and ankle-high, and Will couldn't run more than a few steps before he felt too dizzy to carry on. He slowed to a walk. Lyra looked back. The children hadn't seen them yet. They were still at the front of the house. Maybe they'd take a while to look through all the rooms. But Pantalaimon chirruped in alarm. There was a boy standing at an open window on the second floor of the villa, pointing at them. They heard a shout.
Come on, Will!
She tugged at his good arm, helping him, lifting him. He tried to respond, but he didn't have the strength. He could only walk.
All right. We can't get to the trees, too far away. So we'll go to that temple place. If we shut the door, maybe we can hold them out for long enough to cut through after all.
Pantalaimon darted ahead, and Lyra gasped and called to him breathlessly, making him pause. Will could almost see the bond between them, the demon tugging and the girl responding. He stumbled through the thick grass with Lyra running ahead to see, and then back to help, and then ahead again, until they reached the stone pavement around the temple. The door under the little portico was unlocked, and they ran inside to find themselves in a bare, circular room with several statues of goddesses in niches around the wall. In the very centre, a spiral staircase of wrought iron led up through an opening to the floor above. There was no key to lock the door, so they clambered up the staircase and onto the floorboards of an upper level that was really a viewing place, where people could come to take the air and look out over the city. For there were no windows or walls, simply a series of open arches all the way round supporting the roof. In each archway a windowsill at waist height was broad enough to lean on, and below them the pan-tiled roof ran down in a gentle slope all around to the gutter. As they looked out, they could see the forest behind, tantalizingly close, and the villa below them, and beyond that the open park, and then the red-brown roofs of the city, with the tower rising to the left. There were carrion crows wheeling in the air above the grey battlements, and Will felt a jolt of sickness as he realized what had drawn them there. But there was no time to take in the view. First they had to deal with the children, who were racing up towards the temple, screaming with rage and excitement. The leading boy slowed down and held up his pistol and fired two or three wild shots towards the temple. Then they came on again, yelling,
"Thieves!
Murderers!
We're going to kill you!
You got our knife!
You don't come from
You're going to die!"
Will took no notice. He had the knife out already and swiftly cut a small window to see where they were, only to recoil at once. Lyra looked too and fell back in disappointment. They were 50 feet or so in the air, high above a main road busy with traffic.
Oh, of course. We came up a slope. Well, we're stuck. We'll have to hold them off, that's all.
Another few seconds and the first children were crowding in through the door. The sound of their yelling echoed in the temple and reinforced their wildness. And then came a gunshot, enormously loud, and another, and the screaming took another tone, and then the stairs began to shake as the first ones climbed up. Lyra was crouching paralyzed against the wall, but Will still had the knife in his hand. He scrambled over to the opening in the floor and reached down and sliced through the iron of the top step as if it were paper. With nothing to hold it up, the staircase began to bend under the weight of the children crowding on it, and then it swung down and fell with a huge crash. More screams, more confusion, and again the gun went off, but this time by accident, it seemed. Someone had been hit, and the scream was a pain this time, and Will looked down to see a tangle of writhing bodies covered in plaster and dust and blood. They weren't individual children. They were a single mass like a tide. They surged below him and leaped up in fury, snatching, threatening, screaming, spitting, but they couldn't reach. Then someone called, and they looked to the door, and those who could move surged towards it, leaving several pinned beneath the iron stairs or dazed and struggling to get up from the rubble-strewn floor. Will soon realized why they'd run out. There was a scrabbling sound from the roof outside the arches, and he ran to the windowsill to see the first pair of hands grasping the edge of the pan tiles and pulling up. Someone was pushing from behind, and then came another head and another pair of hands as they clambered over the shoulders and backs of those below and swarmed up onto the roof like ants. But the pan tile ridges were hard to walk on, and the first ones scrambled up on hands and knees, their wild eyes never leaving Will's face. Lyra had joined him, and Pantalaimon was snarling as a leopard, paws on the sill, making the first children hesitate. But still they came on, more and more of them. Someone was shouting,
"Kill! Kill! Kill!"
And then others joined in,
"Kill! Kill! 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 Kill!
Louder and louder, and those on the roof began to stamp and thump the tiles in rhythm, but they didn't quite dare come closer, faced by the snarling demon. Then a tile broke, and the boy standing on it slipped and fell, but the one beside him picked up the broken piece and hurled it at Lyra. She ducked, and it shattered on the column beside her, showering her with broken pieces. Will had noticed the rail around the edge of the opening in the floor and cut two sword-length pieces of it, and he handed one to Lyra now. And she swung it around as hard as she could and into the side of the first boy's head. He fell at once, but then came another, and it was Angelica, red-haired, white-faced, crazy-eyed. She scrambled up onto the sill, but Lyra jabbed the length of rail at her fiercely, and she fell back again. Will was doing the same. The knife was in its sheath at his waist, and he struck and swung and jabbed with the iron rail, and while several children fell back, others kept replacing them, and more were clambering up onto the roof from below. Then the boy in the striped T-shirt appeared, but he'd lost the pistol, or perhaps it was empty. However, his eyes and Will's locked together, and each of them knew what was going to happen. They were going to fight, and it was going to be brutal and deadly.
"Come on,"
said Will, passionate for the battle.
"Come on, then."
Another second, and they would have fought. But then the strangest thing appeared. A great white snow goose swooping low, his wings spread wide, calling and calling so loudly that even the children on the roof heard through their savagery and turned to see.
"Kaiser!"
cried Lyra joyfully, for it was Serafina Pekela's demon. The snow goose called again, a piercing whoop that filled the sky, and then wheeled and turned an inch away from the boy in the striped T-shirt. The boy fell back in fear and slid down and over the edge, and then others began to cry in alarm too because there was something else in the sky. As Lyra saw the little black shape sweeping out of the blue, she cheered and shouted with glee.
"Serafina Pekela! Here! Help us! Here we are! In the temple!"
And with a hiss and rush of air, a dozen arrows, and then another dozen swiftly after, and then another dozen, loosed so quickly that they were all in the air at once, shot at the temple roof above the gallery and landed with a thunder of hammer blows. Astonished and bewildered, the children on the roof felt all the aggression leave them in a moment, and horrible fear rushed in to take its place. What were these black-garbed women rushing at them in the air? How could it happen? Were they ghosts? Were they a new kind of spectre? And whimpering and crying, they jumped off the roof, some of them falling clumsily and dragging themselves away limping, and others rolling down the slope and dashing for safety, but a mob no longer, just a lot of frightened, shame-faced children. A minute after the Snow Goose had appeared, the last of the children left the temple, and the only sound was the rush of air in the branches of the circling witches above. Will looked up in wonder, too amazed to speak, but Lyra was leaping and calling with delight.
Seraphina Pekala! How did she find us? Oh, thank you, thank you! They was going to kill us! Come down and land!
But Seraphina and the others shook their heads and flew up again, to circle high above. The Snow Goose demon wheeled and flew down toward the roof, beating his great wings inward to help him slow down, and landed with a clatter on the pantiles below the sill.
Greetings, Lyra. Seraphina Pekala can't come to the ground, nor can the others. The place is full of specters, 100 or more surrounding the building, and more drifting up over the grass. Can't you see them?
No, we can't see them at all.
Already we've lost one witch. We can't risk any more. Can you get down from this building?
If we jump off the roof like they done. But how did you find us? And where...
Enough now. There's more trouble coming, and bigger. Get down as best you can, and then make for the trees.
They climbed over the sill and moved sideways down through the broken tiles to the gutter. It wasn't high, and below it was grass with a gentle slope away from the building. First Lyra jumped, and then Will followed, rolling over and trying to protect his hand, which was bleeding freely again and hurting badly. His sling had come loose and trailed behind him, and as he tried to roll it up, the Snow Goose landed on the grass at his side.
Lyra, who is this?
It's Will. He's coming with us.
Why are the specters avoiding you?
The goose demon was speaking directly to Will. By this time, Will was hardly surprised by anything, and he said,
I don't know. We can't see them. No, wait.
And he stood up, struck by a thought.
Where are they now? Where's the nearest one?
10 paces away down the slope. They don't want to come any closer, that's obvious.
Will took out the knife and looked in that direction, and he heard the demon hiss with surprise. But Will couldn't do what he intended, because at the same moment a witch landed her branch on the grass beside him. He was taken aback not so much by her flying as by her astounding gracefulness, the fierce, cold, lovely clarity of her gaze, and by the pale, bare limbs, so youthful, and yet so far from being young.
Your name is Will?
Yes, but...
Why are the specters afraid of you?
Because of the knife. Where's the nearest one? Tell me, I want to kill it.
But Lyra came running before the witch could answer.
Seraphina Pekala!
She cried, and she threw her arms around the witch and hugged her so tightly that the witch laughed out loud and kissed the top of her head.
Oh, Seraphina, where did you come from like that? We were... Those kids... They were kids, and they were going to kill us. Did you see them? We thought we were going to die, and... Oh, I'm so glad you came. I thought I'd never see you again.
Seraphina Pekala looked over Lyra's head to where the specters were obviously clustering a little way off, and then looked at Will.
Now listen. There's a cave in these woods not far away. Head up the slope and then along the ridge to the left. The specters won't follow. They don't see us while we're in the air, and they're afraid of you. We'll meet you there. It's a half hour's walk.
And she leapt into the air again. Will shaded his eyes to watch her and the other ragged, elegant figures wheel in the air and dart up over the trees.
Oh, Will, we'll be safe now. It'll be all right now that Seraphina Pekala's here. I never thought I'd see her again. She came just at the right time, didn't she? Just like before at Bolvanger.
Chattering happily as if she'd already forgotten the fight, she led the way up the slope towards the forest. Will followed in silence. His hand was throbbing badly, and with each throb a little more blood was leaving him. He held it up across his chest and tried not to think about it. It took not half an hour, but an hour and three quarters, because Will had to stop and rest several times. When they reached the cave, they found a fire, a rabbit roasting, and Seraphina Pekala stirring something in a small iron pot.
"Let me see your wound,"
was the first thing she said to Will, and he dumbly held out his hand. Pantalaimon, cat-formed, watched curiously, but Will looked away. He didn't like the sight of his mutilated fingers. The witches spoke softly to each other, and then Seraphina Pekala said,
"What weapon made this wound?"
Will reached for the knife and handed it to her silently. Her companions looked at it with wonder and suspicion, for they had never seen such a blade before, with such an edge on it.
"This will need more than herbs to heal. It will need a spell." "Very well. We'll prepare one. It will be ready when the moon rises. In the meantime, you shall sleep."
She gave him a little horn cup containing a hot potion whose bitterness was moderated by honey, and presently he lay back and fell deeply asleep. The witch covered him with leaves and turned to Lyra, who was still gnawing the rabbit.
"Now, Lyra, Tell me who this boy is, and what you know about this world, and about this knife of his.
So Lyra took a deep breath and began.